command, a military command for Africa, is to make this contest to control the resources to be able to fight China and to be able to fight us. When I say us, I'm talking about African people ourselves, for control of our resources in Africa. So this is something that we have to be really conscious of. And damn it, if Obama could unite with Jews in taking land that was stolen from the Arab people, we damn sure have a responsibility to make sure that we unite the masses of African people around the question of Africa. My point is that Israel, they would treat like some kind of foreign policy objective and friend of America. It's our responsibility to make them have to deal with Africa in a better way and to expose Obama and how he would move with Africa and Africa. Uhuru.
Woo, and welcome to Voices of the People, where you participate in a town hall setting where we discuss the current issues happening in the world today with featured guests Omali Eshetela, Chairman of the African Socialist International, and Penny Hess, Chairwoman of the African People Solidarity Committee. And we invite you all listening out there to participate in the discussion that we're going to be having. We're going to give out the numbers momentarily, but we want to move. Of course, the two central issues that we've been discussing for the past few weeks are the economic crisis that is rocking imperialism to its core, and the establishment of Barack Obama as president of the U.S., the highest stage of neocolonialism that is meant to solve imperialism, imperialist white power's crisis. So we're going to kick this thing off. First of all, thank you, Chairman O'Malley Shetella and Chairwoman Penny Hess for being in.
Uhura.
I want to, if we can, perhaps we can start, you know, we've been talking about Obama, who ran his campaign under the slogan change, but who we see is picking many of the usual suspects for his cabinet. Penny, can you give us an update on who we're looking at as part of this Obama crew?
Uhuru, and thank you, Nubinga. It's an honor to be here today, and I want to say uhuru to Chairman O'Malley Shetella. And just to talk about the appointment of Valerie Jarrett as senior advisor, not only on Obama's transition team, but I think that's going to be a permanent position on his staff. Just wanted to talk about her for a minute. She is from Chicago, and you could say that she's part of the upper class of the neocolonial class, or the bourgeoisie of the neocolonial class. Her great-great-grandfather was the first African to go to MIT. Her grandfather was Robert Taylor. There's public housing named after that, after him in Chicago. And her father is a doctor. He's on, I think, on the board of the hospital of University of Chicago, I believe. So she has been an insider with the Obama family for a long time, and worked on his campaigns prior to this. She is the CEO of Habitat, and she has ties to Tony Rezko, who is the Chicago slumlord millionaire who was indicted in a federal trial earlier this year and convicted. So, of course, and Obama does too, that this is the man that Obama bought his house from at a really good deal, and he maneuvered so that his wife bought part of the property so that they could afford it. But I just wanted to say, this is something I found about Valerie Jarrett on a website called Judicial Watch, which is a public interest group that investigates and prosecutes government corruption, announced today that it has obtained documents linking Valerie Jarrett, an advisor, now senior advisor to Barack Obama. And she has been and is the co-chairman of the president-elect's transition team to a series of real estate scandals, including several housing projects operated by convicted felon and Obama fundraiser / friend Antoine Tony Rezko. According to the documents obtained by Judicial Watch from the Illinois Secretary of State, Valerie Jarrett served as a board member for several organizations that provided funding and support for Chicago housing projects operated by real estate developers and Obama financial backers Rezko and Allison Davis. Davis is also Obama's former boss. I think he is a lawyer. Jarrett was a member of the board of directors for the Woodlawn Preservation and Investment Corporation, along with several Davis and Rezko associates, as well as the Fund for Community Redevelopment and Revitalization, an organization that worked with Rezko and Davis. And I believe that was the organization that got millions and millions of dollars of HUD money for redevelopment of properties in the most impoverished areas of Chicago, and then, of course, ended up leaving those properties in hideous condition and made tons of money for themselves. According to press reports, housing projects operated by Davis and Rezko have been sustained have been substandard and beset with code violations. The Chicago Sun-Times reported that one Rezko-managed housing project was, quote, riddled with problems, including squalid living conditions, lack of heat, etc. As chief executive officer of the Habitat Company, Valerie Jarrett also managed a controversial housing project located in Obama's former state Senate district called Grove Park Plaza. And you can actually see that. There's YouTube videos on that. If you Google Grove Park Plaza, you can see people walking through that and filming it and what the conditions are. According to the Boston Globe, the housing complex was considered uninhabitable by unfixed problems, such as collapsed roofs and fire damage. In 2006, federal inspectors graded the condition of the complex as 11 on a 100-point scale, a score so bad the buildings now face demolition. Ms. Jarrett refused to comment to the Globe on the conditions of the complex. And, you know, it goes on to say, like Barack Obama, Valerie Jarrett is a product of the corrupt Chicago political machine. And it is no stretch to say that she was a slumlord, said Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton. We have real concerns about Jarrett's ethics. Washington already has plenty of corruptions. We don't need to import more of it from Chicago. Anyway, that's just some statements about her. But, you know, again, I've seen blogs online by African people who have lived or who live in Obama's district or former districts, and who, you know, who say that he did nothing. Obama did nothing for them. The conditions are terrible. People can look at that as some kind of indication of what, you know, his presidency is going to represent.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I also saw that I think it was a short documentary on the that housing project, and it was ridiculous the mm-hmm. kind of conditions that Africans were forced to live in, and it was right in Obama's district, or right on the edge of Obama's district. Chairman, what do you think we're looking at when we see Valerie, this woman Valerie Jarrett, coming in, even them talking about, you know, Hillary Clinton possibly being the Secretary of State? What is it that we're looking at here?
Obviously, this whole notion of change is just ridiculous, and we've said this all along. One of the things that I find striking is Obama's response in August, I think it was August 1st, that we intervened in this town hall meeting that he had here in St. Petersburg, and we challenged him around the question of what was happening to African people in these foreclosures and thousands of people losing their homes. And he controlled the mic, so he was able to deflect the significance of the question, because he spoke out about, he said something it was bad that people were being foreclosed, but he did not mention that the chief forecloser, or the ones who most responsible for this predicament, the actual person who turned what had always been recognized as predatory lending into something that was presentable, something that that was now okay in the banking world, was his finance chair person, Penny Pritzker. Now, that in and of itself is kind of significant, but you could say, well, you know, maybe Obama just didn't know. Of course, she's out of Chicago, too. And somehow she sneaked her way into his campaign. But then you look at this woman, Jarrett, who's also a slumlord, tied into the housing thing. What is this guy? Obama's supposed to be some kind of community organizing. What the hell is he organizing? And then you have, of course, Resco, who also made a fortune in bad housing that left people in just terrible circumstances. Obviously, Obama, and something that I think even the most optimistic supporter of Obama did not expect, that he would he would necessarily be better than the white guys. I think they did not anticipate the depth of which he is connected to not just ordinary white guys with power, but to the depth of the near criminal kind of exploitation, and particularly as it's directed at African people. I would say also that that when people have high positions like this, when they're voted into office, it's always been recognized by the African People's Socialist Party that politics is simply concentrated economics. And when you have these forces who run for president and get elected, they represent the interests of a bourgeoisie. The thing that makes the Barack Obama phenomenon really interesting is that there is no African bourgeoisie as such. There is no social force in the African community that owns and controls the means of production. The means of production are still in the hands, essentially, of white people, white power. So unlike a traditional representative of imperialism in an office like this that looks out for his own interests, or when I say all his own class, and look at what happened with this guy Cheney as an example, who was tied to oil, Bush tied to oil, and they made trillions of dollars, the whole groups of them. In this instance, what you have is Obama represents imperialism that continues to rest upon a pedestal of the exploitation of everybody else. So even Obama's being in power would naturally be representing capital that primarily exploits African people, primarily exploits Mexican people, primarily exploits oppressed peoples around the world. And I think this is just something of interest worth noting. But I think for us, the reality is that, not to get tied up into Obama as the worst president. We got all this research on Obama. Why didn't you have it on Hillary or somebody else? The fact is that Obama represented himself in the world as something different from all of these other forces. That's how he put himself forth. I didn't define him. He defined himself as that, in that fashion. He defined himself as representing change. He talked about, these things, and I think it's reasonable to hold him accountable to that. But more than that, I think we have to be concerned because we recognize that the issue never was whether a particular representative of imperialism would solve the problems of the masses of the peoples of the world. We've always been able to condemn imperialism as a social system. We're not race nationalists who somehow assume that if a Negro is at the helm of this terrible, oppressive, exploitative system, it is somehow going to be better. And even if we were among that group who might, of Africans, a tiny group who might benefit from the election of Obama, if we are opposed to the system of imperialism, we would have to be opposed to Obama. And the thing that gives us a problem with Obama is that he is imperialism in camouflage. He is imperialism for a short period of time will be successful in representing, I guess successful, representing itself as at the service of the people. And the fact of the matter is that it's the people's struggles to take back their resources that made it necessary for imperialism to elevate Obama to the position that he's in right now.
And, I find it interesting, because in the African world, you have people, even forces who, have been tied to struggle, who are viewing this election of a Negro as something that's going to bring some type of benefit, even in places where we see, Negroes who have been put in power,
Yeah. I mean, that's, we refer to that as philosophical idealism, where the idea of something is more important than the reality that it, you know, that it represents in the real world. And this is the thing that's really trying, you know, that the masses, that you find these people who call themselves leaders and revolutionaries, et cetera, who truly have do not conceive of and cannot conceive of being in power, cannot conceive of the end of imperialism, who can only hope that imperialism with a new face is going to be favorable to us. If imperialism looks like us, if the representative of imperialism looks like us, then perhaps that's going to be our salvation. And that is something to behold, especially in an era where it's become increasingly clear that imperialism is in deep and profound crisis, but the only way forward is for revolution. And how do you get a so-called revolutionary to make revolution if the confidence is in an imperialism with a black face? And is that really a revolutionary that you're looking at? Or do we have a situation now where the white nationalism that exists, you know, deep down inside is permitted to reveal itself because there's an African who holds this high position, you know, like in office? You know, it's a certain kind of patriotism toward an imperialist system. And we hear this coming from so-called revolutionary Africans. We hear this is an extraordinary situation. And I think this is an era, a time in history where lines will, the ultimate lines will be drawn, and revolutionary forces who represent themselves now are forces that are going to have to smash through this liberal, petty, punkish perception of reality that's somehow a Negro who represent imperialism can be good for the mass of our people. Again, these are folk who are not well grounded ideologically, theoretically. They have no confidence in the masses and have all confidence in imperialism especially if it can represent itself as another African or somebody who looks like them. It is something to behold, and it says something about what our task is right now, and about how important it is for us to hold firm to revolutionary principles and to advance the revolution and try to build revolutionary organization and try to educate masses of people so that they can see beyond the facade that imperialism has presented us with today in the form of a Barack Obama. These are serious times, but I truly believe, I've said it in the past, that sometimes you reach a point in history where history is compressed, and things that formerly took, you know, maybe generations to occur happened almost overnight. In many ways, even the election of Obama represents that compression of history, where imperialism has to move in a certain kind of way in order to save itself. But I believe that Obama is like a comet. And as beautiful as comets are, they are going across the sky. They burn out, and I think that's what we're going to have. I know that's what we're going to have. History will not permit the masses of our people to continue to suffer just because a fast-talking, new, dark-skinned representative of imperialism is given to us as a solution to the problems that we are confronted with. Yeah.
I want to open it up for questions from our studio audience and from those of you listening out there. If you want to participate in this discussion, you can call in to one of our numbers. There's the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. There's the U.K. number, which is 020-8133-6629. That's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Go ahead.
Uhuru, it's really fantastic to be here in the studio today. This is my first time here. I've certainly been listening to the shows and really appreciate Chairman Amalia Shetela and Penny Hess and the party's whole analysis. The information that came out last week and then what Penny was just bringing out about Obama's staff just made me understand what the party's been saying. They portray Obama as this community organizer from Chicago,
South Side or whatever. But he was just part of the Daily Machine, which really was brought out last week, and that's just like the Irish organized crime. You know, the Irish Mafia that's been the front of imperialism from Chicago, that's the son, and it was a continuation of his father, Daly, and just even today reinforced for me why they had to kill Fred Hampton because to have an Obama. And because they said that the Black Panther Party was the greatest internal threat to the U.S. And, of course, they meant to themselves. And clearly that's what Fred Hampton stood for. Because the African working class is the greatest internal threat to imperialism and white power, be it neocolonialism or Daly or whoever. And I just want to ask the chairman in terms of the paper the party, the chairman put out in Amherst, Massachusetts, in the late 70s, Tactics and Strategy for Black Liberation, how the chairman sees the relevancy of that to the situation that we have today.
Well, the issue of tactics and strategies for Black liberation, we laid out several different tactics that we thought would be necessary for realizing a strategical objective of the liberation of African people. And, you know, central to that, of course, was winning African people to the recognition of the need to be independent, to winning them to the position of political independence. And, of course, temporarily, the Barack Obama phenomenon has won no, that's not without any doubt. Even people who didn't vote, I think, generally speaking, we can say that the Obama phenomenon has temporarily brought the majority of African people back into the embrace of imperialism. But the problem with Obama is the fact that that people can be tricked and can be fooled. But it's easy, the people are easily fooled when they think that the direction they're going is in the interest is in their best interest. And that's what Obama's presence, it, not his statements, but his presence, because he's Black, he's African, and because there's a trajectory that Africans have been in for 400 or 500 years toward freedom, toward emancipation, that Obama hijacked this, you know, and jumped on this trajectory. So people have assumed that his being elected means something positive for us, means that we're going to, things are going to change and can be better. Now, they are, you know, astute, you know, politicians in our community, whether they are elected or not. You know, some of them, you know, like religious forces of Muslim, Christians, and what have you, and some of them community organizers, if you will, and revolutionaries who will say, well, you got to give him time. He can't do this and he can't do that. Well, people look to have their lives change. People are not, people want change. People want real change. And Obama hijacked our demand for change and for revolution and gave it an imperialist twist, a spin, if you will. And what we have a responsibility to do is to continue to demand genuine change, genuine transformation, push for revolution, and because that's the direction that masses are going into. And what will be discovered in short time is that nothing significant is going to happen around the war, that Obama is going to be forced to stand on the wrong side of so many questions involving Africans and other peoples around the world that masses of Africans, well, they are even prepared to struggle right now if there is enough courage within our circles and ranks to pursue issues and struggles and et cetera. People want to struggle right now. And I think this is what is going to happen, is that this objective reality is going to hit this whole idea of Obama being the salvation and crush it. And people will be open at this time, because nothing then will be standing between the people. Neocolonialism will not be an effective buffer anymore. Mm-hmm. And Nkrumah was absolutely correct when he said that neocolonialism is the final stage. It's the last stage of imperialism. And so this is, you know, going past Obama, what next? Okay, you became the president and that didn't do anything for you. What you got to do now? And that is, of course, is to take our own power on our own terms, liberate our Africa, unify our people around the world, and participate in developing a new world, not one that has a black face that sits at the helm of exploitation, oppression of peoples around the world, but one that where oppression, exploitation no longer exists. That's what we have to do, and that's what we have to continue to push. And what you're going to do is you're going to see more and more is that these so-called leftists and revolutionaries who are in the camp of Obama are going to have to expose themselves as the jaded, corrupt, and opportunistic forces they are, because they're going to have to defend imperialism. They're going to have to defend Obama staying in Iraq and making war in Afghanistan and possibly in Pakistan. They're going to have to defend Obama's attack on the people in Latin America and what have you. They're going to have to defend Obama's unwillingness to do anything at all about AFRICOM and the exploitation of Africa. And they're going to have to defend Obama's reluctance to take on any critical questions that's significant to Africans as a people in this country. And that's going to expose them as well. And that's good, because it gives an open field to people who are truly involved in trying to make revolutionary transformation and overturning a foul, rotten social system based on slavery and genocide.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Last week we had a lot of questions come in, and I want to throw in one or two here that came from last week that I think are relevant this week. One was asking, how do the leaders of countries like Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, Paraguay, and Nicaragua feel about an Obama win? And will they be willing to sit down with the U.S. and Obama to talk about their differences? Also, we know that Obama was celebrated all over Africa. How can we make the Africans understand who Obama really is? And that is coming from Ona. So, whoever would like to take that on.
Well, I think that the question, the last part of the question was the willingness to sit down and talk. But what was the initial?
The initial question was, how do leaders of countries, those countries, feel about?
Here's one of the problems that all the so-called leaders, in particular progressive and revolutionary forces, around the world, the historical problem they've had with the United States, in the United States, because in the United States, there's a near absence of a revolutionary opposition. There's, you know, loyal opposition and what have you. There are people who end up doing just what the left and so-called revolutionaries did in this instance, is uniting with a sector of the Democratic Party. In fact, the Communist Party of USA used to have what they call its congressional strategy, where as opposed to promoting revolutionary transformation, they would end up supporting different politicians, Negro, or not just Negro, sometimes Negro, but so-called progressive politicians, and see that as the way forward. So you have a situation where revolutionaries around the world are looking at the United States. The question is, who can they look to in the United States as ally with whom they can align and say, you know, there's a revolutionary force that we can connect with in this country, in the United States, which is the most powerful imperialist force in the world that can be aligned with us in struggling against imperialism. And the problem is, generally speaking, that hasn't been the case, with the exception of forces like our own, and which historically have not had the ink. That when I say ink, I mean the publicity, so that we are as well known or respected. And sometimes because the so-called progressive and revolutionaries fall victim to the notion of what is the most representative so-called left or revolutionary force in the United States, they end up having to accept the Obama, the best, they like to call it the lesser of two evils. We like to call it the evil of two lessers. But they end up, you know, supporting this strategy of a so-called revolutionary left inside this country. That's generally speaking, that's how it goes. I don't know how, I've heard some criticism, I think, coming before the election from Hugo Chavez in Venezuela about some statements Obama has made that I thought was right on. And so I don't know, generally speaking, how that's going to affect, you know, how they move. I'm hoping that we are successful enough in promoting our revolutionary project internationally that we can impact on that question. The other question, though, is like, you know, Obama presents himself as this wonderful person because he's willing to negotiate where others are willing to simply shoot and kill. And these are simply two different strategies of imperialism about how do you keep the stolen resources. I mean, you break into somebody's house, steal all their stuff, and you're willing to negotiate with them as opposed to shoot them. I mean, what kind of a progressive thing is that? So the differences that most of the people have with the United States are not some differences of opinions about some things, but the differences are based on the fact that the United States has stolen their resources, has overthrown their leaders, has killed those who it could not necessarily overthrow, has created structures, international structures and organizations that's designed to keep people in poverty. So the question is, what's the basis of the negotiation? I mean, obviously, there are some policies of imperialism that it might be helpful for someone to negotiate out of the way. It might be of some use, et cetera, moving toward the ultimate aim of getting imperialism out of the lives of the people. But actually, that's not such a wonderful thing that Obama says that, well, you know, I'm willing to talk to somebody from whom we stole and everything. I mean, Iran is the big boogeyman that they use as an example. In this instance, you know, the current Iranian president. Well, the current Iranian president is somebody who's in power now as a part of a trajectory, a political trajectory that overthrew a criminal, this terrible dictatorship that the U.S. government put there after overthrowing a legitimately elected government of Iran in 1954. So you got all these people who hated the United States because of what it had done, the misery that's been imposed upon them. This thug who represented U.S. imperialism as a military outpost working along with the illegitimate white nationalist settler state of Israel to control the oil and guarantee that they were going to have those resources, and they didn't care. They didn't care about what it meant to the people of Iran, how they had to live under this dictatorship. Now you got a whole group of people who, in response, who overthrow this government, and now they're in power, and now they have a particular attitude toward the United States, not because it didn't just pop in their heads, but because of what the United States has historically and is doing right now. Right now, the United States has groups incursions going into Iran, committing sabotage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, trying to block its progress in various international arenas, et cetera. So what is there to negotiate? You know, the United States needs to get out of there, needs to get stop interfering in the lives of the people of Iran and the rest of the world. So, you know, I hope that was significant in responding. I mean, to the owner out there. Yeah.
Uhura. Uhura.
Cyberspace, is that what you call it?
Yeah, out in cyberspace. Is there something you wanted to add?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. I want to switch gears a little bit. And talk a bit about the economic crisis that the U.S. and imperialism in general is experiencing. Penny, I know you have been really staying on top of this. I want to play a clip that I've got from CBS where. Talking about the in particular Chicago, where there are going to be a bunch of layoffs, and Mayor Daley is speaking about that situation. So I'm going to play a short clip here, and then we're going to get into this discussion about the economic crisis.
And some dire comments about the economy from Mayor Daley. The mayor says the economic woes in Chicago will get much worse. CBS 2's Joni Lum is live at Union Station now with more on what he's hearing from CEOs in the city. Good morning, Joni.
Good morning, Roseanne. It's rather alarming because we're talking about the private industry, not just city jobs. And so it seems the city that works is the city that's about to get laid off. Add to that, federally, radically financial changes are also changing the federal bailout. Now, the big three automakers are also saying that they could go bankrupt. Lawmakers say if the auto industry goes down, the huge number of jobs lost would cause more house foreclosures. Yesterday, Mayor Daley joined with local gas company officials to announce new programs to help low-income customers pay their heating bills. He disclosed that local corporate leaders are telling him many Chicagoans will be out of work because they are planning huge layoffs in November and December.
This is going to be all year, so it's going to be a very frightening economy. And each one of them tell me what they're laying off, and they're going to double that next year. So you're talking about huge numbers of permanent layoffs for people in the economy. It's going to have a huge effect upon all businesses.
And Mayor Daley warned that local governments will also be in jeopardy and might not have enough money to meet payroll, although he's not worried about paying City of Chicago employees. Now, the city's budget, by the way, will be voted on November 19th. It contains layoffs, a slowdown in police hiring, new taxes and fines. Some of that bad news for taxpayers who have jobs right now. Live near Union Station, Joni Lum, CBS.
So, Chicago, the city that works, is out of work. Penny.
Uhuru. Well, first of all, I just want to express my unity with the discussion and the analysis the chairman has been putting out, earlier in this program, and just the crisis that imperialism is facing right now. I think that is an example of just one place, of one city, that is very important to the U.S. economy. But we are looking at not just a crisis, but really, I believe that we're in the middle of the collapse of the U.S. economy, and therefore, the U.S. imperialism in a certain way, because at least as we know it, quote unquote, because we're looking at a situation where, although some of these things have happened in the past, because I know the automakers have been bailed out. I think they were bailed out in the 70s, and I know that the city of New York went bankrupt in the 70s. But that was a, quote, recession. That was something that, did not indicate a complete collapse the way it is now. There's no sector of the U.S. economy that's untouched by this crisis. And I think that, first of all, it's really important to look at it because all of the economists out there on cyberspace or, in the newspaper that are trying to, or CNN or MSNBC that are trying to give an analysis to this are failing to do that because they can't understand that the United States, as the chairman has told us, and capitalism itself is built on the enslavement of African people for 500 years. It's built on genocide of the indigenous people, the theft of their land, and it's built on a colonial structure that enables there to be a pedestal on which the white population and some of the neo-colonialists from around the world to enjoy. And if we don't understand that, it's like, a doctor trying to diagnose cancer by studying somebody's headache. I mean, it's just like limiting down to a myopic view of what is happening instead of really recognizing that we're in this collapse. And that is really key. Now, we look at all the sectors, and just to say, Chairman, first of all, if you were looking at the collapse of the society, you'd be looking at the collapse of the economy, the collapse of the state, and other things as well. Even the military, which I know is part of the state, but let's say the foreign policy as well. So, you have the situation where, like Daley's talking about, Chicago, you know, is having serious problems. And he said, well, we're going to be able to pay salaries. But then in the very next sentence, she said, but the budget comes up on the 19th, and there are going to be huge layoffs, including the police. Now, I think it's really important to realize there's already been articles in the New York Times saying that the city of New York has laid off 1,700 cops. And the city of Vallejo, which went bankrupt in California, is lost almost its whole budget. 80% of its budget was for police and fire department. And it's losing, you know, laying off tons of those. So you're beginning to see the collapse or the weakening of the state, of the apparatus of the state. And, you know, just the kind of thing that we're talking about, it's not just Chicago. Nutter, who's the mayor of Philadelphia, authored this letter, which he said he is personally delivering to Paulson. Good luck. And he has other signers on it saying that calling for $50 billion of the bailout to go to U.S. cities. And the ones that are, of course, in dire shape are Philadelphia. There's Detroit, which because of the auto industry is in deep crisis. Atlanta and Phoenix, Arizona. These are some places that are you know, you're reading about right now, although every city and every state, I mean, the whole state of California is, you know, is in the same crisis. And Schwarzenegger asked for $7 billion from the bailout to go there. And it, you know, it's just a completely interesting situation because we're talking about every state. For one thing, every state in the United States and every municipal government had investments in the derivatives, the mortgage-backed securities that were based on the subprime mortgages. And I know the state of Florida has already lost millions and millions of dollars that way. So the states are facing crisis. In this past week, new data came out that talked about foreclosures in the United States were up 25% in the month of October, with 85,000 foreclosures in October, plus 280,000 households that got foreclosure notice or were in default in October. So that's a total of 936,439,000 foreclosures since last August of 2007. And it's, you know, it's just increasing constantly. The new unemployment data for this week, claims are up to 500,000 a week. General Motors, this is very serious to the U.S. economy about General Motors for two reasons. One is that General Motors is part of I think the chairman has talked about, the American brand. Mm-hmm. Like if Ford and General Motors and Coca-Cola and things that are really identified with the United States collapse, that is very serious to the U.S. image around the world. But that's one thing. But the second thing
also
is
to the psyche of the people who are here, you see. Yeah.
Right. And but a GM bankruptcy, which right now the Bush administration and Paulson are saying they're not going to bail it out. Although Obama is saying that he would and he wants to, the thing is that it's doubtful that GM could last until January 20th when Obama is inaugurated. It is in such a serious situation. The U.S. auto industry, because if GM goes down, Ford and all of the Chrysler and the other ones are going to go with it. U.S. auto industry is responsible for 1 in 10 of every job in the United States. Hmm. That means, and not only the current jobs, because that also means dealerships, car dealerships, it means auto parts, stores, it means everything affiliated with cars that you can think about. But also the auto industry is now paying pensions of millions of people who are in retirement. That would go. And the auto industry is responsible for an enormous amount of health care, because if you take each worker, say 1 in 10 worker, let's say they have a family of four. So you're talking about, you know, four times that in terms of the number of people on health care. because of that. I mean, it is just, you know, it's really, really serious. And the things that I have that I think is really important is that, first of all, a bailout won't help. It really won't help. It will give them a few months, maybe a year at the most. But it's not like Wall Street that was just feeding the bankers and, you know, these so-called bad debts. This is a huge business apparatus that has to run and pay salaries every single day. And a bailout is not going to help, you know, the people buy cars. It's not gonna help people have money, you know, to deal with the what caused this crisis. It's just going to keep, you know, this sort of machinery running for a limited period of time. So bailout won't help, but I do think that it's really psychologically, again, really important to understand that this government gave $700 billion to the bankers in the bailout, but they will not give, you know, what will really, really affect millions of people's jobs. They won't give it to the people. I mean, even psychologically, they ought to do that. And I think that is what, you know, Obama is kind of talking about. But again, where is the U.S. going to get the money for that? Chrysler, by the way, there was just an article, Chrysler leaders get millions. So it says automaker defends payouts amid looming bailout talks. So Chrysler is also going bankrupt. But while they're doing that, they're paying $30 million in bonuses to their top executives as the company cuts thousands of jobs. And you're talking about, like, the executive vice president of manufacturing gets a bonus, not a salary, of $1.8 million. Frank Cligon, executive vice president product development. Now, talk about somebody ought to get fired. He gets $1.8 million bonus at Christmas time. I mean, you know, this is, it's really deep. I mean, how is the U.S. just going to deal with that? Then, okay, we talked about the state of California facing bankrupt. You know, Philadelphia has a $108 million shortfall. They're shutting libraries, swimming pools, reducing all social programs, et cetera. We see that the stock market is down nearly 50% from earlier this year. So you're talking about earlier this year, the Dow traded at 15,000. Right now it's down in the 8,000s. And this week it's going down every day. And one day it really went below 8. And then mysteriously, at the end of the day, it went up because they don't want it to go into the sevens. Mm-hmm. But, it, you know, they have this thing called the plunge protection team where the Federal Reserve puts millions of dollars into the stock market just to keep it afloat day after day. So I just think that, you know, we have seen Circuit City is in bankruptcy. It's in Chapter 11. And this is, you know, before the holiday season. There's a whole article on all the malls, the owners of malls. One of the big owners of, you know, corporations that owns malls is $1 billion in debt, and they're filing for Chapter 11. But if you also look at the endangered business list, every store that's in the mall is on it. You know, all this Macy's and Dillard's and JCPenney's is barely making it. Sears is in deep trouble. You know, there's going to be Walmart after Christmas. There's going to be Walmart, and that's going to be it. And now Sun Microsystems is laying off 6,000.
And the big box opponents are going to love it.
Right, exactly. I even heard on major news, I think it was NPR, warning, do not buy gift cards and do not accept gift cards because it might not, you know, the store might be closed by the time you try to go redeem it after Christmas. So also this week, American Express, which is a credit card company, turned itself into a bank this week so that it could get some of the bailout money. And I think this is interesting, though. Bloomberg, who's, of course, the mayor, and maybe forever, the mayor of New York, sued the U.S. government around transparency in the bailout. Of course, he wants some of that money. But it is interesting that it is nobody knows where this money has gone. There's no accounting. It's totally secret. Go ahead, Chairman.
No, I was just going to say, and this is, again, the question of where Obama's change is, you know, it seems to me like is really important, because I just saw something, I think, yesterday or the day before that said Paulson, who is the guy who's overseeing this process up to now, has $510 billion in Goldman Sachs. And so does his brother. So his brother and Paulson and his brother have $1 billion together in Goldman Sachs, which is on the top of the list to be rescued by this thing. But one of the things I just really want to say is that we have a responsibility to build organization and to educate masses of people, and that it's not going to be good enough to simply whine about Obama. We have to organize, and we have to build a revolutionary organization that with the intent to take power. And, I mean, that's what it's all about. If you're not talking about power, you might as well try to get on the list, move to Chicago and get on the list to be a part of his team. But the question is, that's essentially what we have to do. And it's also important to recognize that what the imperialists are doing now with the Obamas, one aspect of this phenomenon, they're trying to broaden the imperialist camp. They're trying to open it up, recognizing that the traditional U.S. so-called Western imperialist camp is not enough. You know, they're moving even from beyond the so-called Group of Seven. They had to let Russia in. Group of Seven plus Eight. Now they're talking about, what's this group that just met, the 20? The G20, Group of 20. And the 20 is South Africa, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, all these other things, India. So what they're trying to do is broaden this thing, and where a much larger number now rests upon this pedestal of oppression, you see. And of course, the one problem for us is that Africa still remains the pedestal. And so you've got all these groups invited to join, get on top of this pedestal with the U.S., with white power, and they will do so at the expense of Africa, and they will do so at the expense of peoples, even in their own countries and what have you. So we have to be a revolutionary organization, and we have to be especially concerned about building the African Socialist International with the objective of unifying and liberating Africa and African people worldwide. Other than if we don't do that, we're just talking. And I, you know, unfortunately, like, these discussions happen, sort of in a vacuum. It does not offer us much opportunity to talk about the kind of actual political work that we're doing around the world. So we're not just somebody whining about Obama. We actually have organization on the ground throughout North America, in Africa, in Europe, et cetera, where we engage, and we are trying to move into Central. We are actively involved in trying to extend our reach into South America right now. So the thing is that we're not just complaining. We are actually trying to give an analysis upon which our organization and our strategy will be based.
Yes, Chairman, I appreciate that. I unite with that. And I just want to say, because as a member of the African People's Solidarity Committee, you know, of the white organization that works under the leadership of the African People's Socialist Party and was formed by the party, and working in the white community, it's really important for other white people to recognize this is not a time to be clinging to a single issue or self-interest or any kind of opportunist thing. Because, first of all, we're in a time where, you know, we're in this contraction of capitalism. We're in this contraction and collapse of, you know, a lifestyle full of resources for many years or for centuries based on the suffering of other people around the world. And that is over. You know, there might be a little residual of it, but it's over. And so each little single issue is nothing more than a sector of the white population fighting for white power, fighting for white rights at the expense of everybody else in a very desperate kind of way. And I'm talking about things like the gay marriage issue, you know, that was defeated under, you know, the same election that Obama won. And, you know, all the other kinds of issues. It's very, very dangerous. Even the question of white people working for peace internationally, you know, to end the U.S. war is very dangerous because, first of all, we're at a time where we have to come together in an entire strategy to bring down imperialism, and the only way that could happen is under the revolutionary movement of the African working class. That's what's going to defeat imperialism. That's the only way that we can, you know, be part of something that is going to get rid of oppression on this planet and get rid of oppressors and oppressed.
Right on. And that's it for Voices of the People. But stay tuned because we're going to have on Luwazi Kinshasa and Chernow Alpha Mba, both from the African Socialist International, based in very different parts of the world, talking about the situation in Guinea-Conakry and the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
In EDUM, the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement presents the Justice for Ricky Bishop Memorial March, taking place 22nd November 2008. No to police containment, yes to social justice and economic development for the entire African community. March starting at Brixton Library, going down to Brixton Police Station, and then through Camberwell to Peckham Square. For more information, contact NPDOM on 0208-265-1731 or 0773-067-486.
If you would like to see an end to all forms of violence in the black community, join the Ricky Bishop Memorial March.
Africa Live.
Yeah, he listens. He told me that
Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live.
Africa Live. You see, what I'm saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us. About Barack Obama, don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. African internationalism in action, y'all. You need to get up on this. when we say we have to have power in our own hands, here we're talking about the African working class. What we can do, is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands.
Africa Live. Africa Live.
just raise up these incredible African leaders that we've had. It's critical that as African people, we strive to be like them. I'm talking about the Marcus Garvey. I'm talking about the Fannie Lou Hamers. I'm talking about the Malcolm X's.
Okay. Also calling me Wazy right now, trying to get him.
We have Omali Eshitella.
Brothers and sisters, Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live.
The International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement.
Okay, hold on one moment. I'm trying to get Louise on with us. Uhuru, Louise. Uhuru, comrade. Hello, are we getting some kind? Can you hear me? I can hear you. Can you hear me? I can hear you. Yes. You can hear me? Okay. Okay. Great. You don't have the broadcast going on in the background, do you? No, I can't hear it. I was making sure. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right, we're about to go live then. Louise, I can hear you. I think I'm hearing you breathing into the microphone. I think so. Okay. Okay, go ahead.
Binga?
You hold on a comment, I think he's talking on the radio.
Uhuru, welcome to Africa Live on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe. And we are going to be talking about some issues that are, you know, there are issues challenging the current world order all over the world. Neocolonialism, the form of imperialism where the colonial system is administered by a comprador class from amongst the colonized themselves, is showing signs of real crisis in various places. Two such places are Guinea-Conakry and the Democratic Republic of Congo, both in Africa. In Guinea, rebellions have challenged the government, while in the Democratic Republic of Congo, conflict between various forces has been ongoing for quite some time. On today, we have with us Louisa Kinshasa, who is the Secretary General of the African Socialist International and is joining us from England, and Cherno Alpha Mba, who is the Director of Organization of the African Socialist International, who is joining us from Sierra Leone. Uhuru, comrades, and welcome.
Yes, Uhuru, comrade, being great to be on the radio, Uhuru Radio again.
It's good.
Thank you very much for having us.
It's good to have y'all. It's good to have y'all back. Just to kick it off, Comrade Cherno, can you tell us exactly what this is that is happening in Guinea?
I'm sure the Guinea situation is not something that is new anymore. We should remember that in last year, sometime a year ago, sometime in January and February 2007, there was a mass national uprising that was carried out, initiated by the people against the new colonial government of Lassana Conte, who has been in power since 1984 and who has run the country bankrupt, allowing, giving away the resources that we have in that area to multinational corporations, Alcoa and Alcan, and several other corporations who are involved in the theft of aluminium, gold, and other resources from Guinea-Conakry. And the thing is that people have been living under that state of terror, this terror, violence, exploitation of resources. They've been living under abject poverty for over 20 years of a contest government. And the thing that happened is that the demonstrations were designed as part of the desperate effort of the masses to take control over our resources and to kick the new colonial government of Lassana Conte, who has been in power since 1984 and who has been working as a puppet of the United States and France to facilitate the theft of resources. So, as we know, that rebellion ended in a settlement that was carried out by the civilians in the name of the people's struggle. The civilians exploited the strength and efforts of the masses, and they had what they call Lassana Kouyaté, who was imposed as a settlement of that particular situation. So for the past 4 weeks, we have been witnessing an ongoing struggle by the people, the desperate effort to overturn the condition that they have been facing as a consequence of this situation. And it started with protests over the rising cost of commodity prices. Fuel prices have gone up sharply in Guinea-Conakry, and rice and other commodity prices as well have gone beyond the purchasing power of the people who have who are left in the backward situation, and they have no access to resources that will facilitate their conditions of existence. So they've been coming out on the streets, challenging the police and demanding that the government of Lassana Kouyaté and all the corporations that are involved in the theft of the resources and the persuasion of the people should leave Guinea. So this we have received is that the people who have attacked trains that are moving out the aluminium from Kamsar and other places in the country. These trains are owned by corporations like Arco, Alcan, the little North American aluminium corporations that are involved in the theft of resources in Guinea. So 2 weeks ago, the government has stepped out and they have deployed police in Conakry and all the strategic places in the country. From what we have been receiving information coming out from Guinea, that the border has been closed by the country government, and police checkpoints have been erected in almost all strategic areas of Conakry, preventing people from moving out of their homes and even going in and out of Conakry itself. So there's a state siege, but the protests have been ongoing in an isolated front in several areas, like in the commune of Bambeto, in the Andalayan areas. And there have been fierce running battles involved, you know, where police and young people, youth positions, have been engaging the police in running battles and all of that. So there's a general state of siege and uprisings going on in Conakry right now, and the government has the martial law as expected. And that there are reports that have been imposed 4 days ago that it still removed them of people. You know, people are not allowed to come out of the streets from 5 p.m. To 6 a.m. in the morning as part of the effort of the government and its police force to suppress the rebellion. So it's a very tense and very present situation and a desperate effort, an ongoing effort by the Maoists to challenge the Ukrainian government of our country as responsible for the conditions that we have been taking since 1984 up to now.
Now, is there any connection here with the rebellions that occurred on last year?
Pardon?
I was asking, is there any connection here with the rebellions that occurred on last year?
Yes, the thing is that the interesting thing about this, you know, it's expected that this ongoing rebellion may have been influenced by the situation that happened last year. You know, we have been pointing out that the settlement that was done last year as a divided trade between the two and the government of Guinea that resulted in the settlement of last year, it was not actually representative of the interests and desires of the masses to free themselves from the ongoing situation that they are confronted with. The conditions that have been imposed on them by the corporation. So it was expected that that settlement was going to collapse. So even last year, early this year, there was an ongoing effort by the trade unions themselves, because some of the trade union leaders made that deal because they were expecting some form of a paycheck from the new Ukrainian government and corporations made by the U.S. and itself in Conakry. So some of the trade union leaders were appointed to strategic positions within the government, while others did not benefit from the deal. So they have been pushing, and they succeeded in having that removed from office. So the president himself appointed his own tools to serve as the prime minister in place of Latin America. So this current demonstration, this rebellion, is one that is directly related to the strikes and the national uprising of January after 2007. It's an ongoing thing. The thing is that National Creator was imposed as a consequence of a deal that was made, a compromise that was made by the union leadership, which claimed that it was representing the aspiration of the people, but it did not. So the settlement was made in opposition to the genuine aspiration of the people. So it was expected that sooner or later there was going to be a rebellion challenging that particular arrangement, because the arrangement that was done last year in 2007 was not one that was directly tied to the genuine aspiration of people for, you know, their freedom from the ongoing conditions that have been imposed on them by, you know, decades of one-party neo-colonial dictatorship facilitated by the set of resources and the administration of the conditions that they have been taking. So it is not surprising that since the start of these demonstrations, even the trade union leadership itself has not been able to claim control over the leadership. This is just an uprising that sprang up from the masses as a consequence of the fact that they are faced with conditions that they know imposed on them by the failure of the new colonial government of Latin America to address the conditions that they face. And it's one that is directly targeted, you know, on the corporations and the government itself, because the corporations like Alcoa and Alcan and their subsidiary institutions have ceased their operations at a particular time. There is no mining activity that's happening in Conakry in the strategic areas in Bouke and Kampala. So this latest round of demonstrations are directly tied to the rebellions that happened in January and February of 2007.
Now, so we're looking at the connection between these rebellions and the theft of these resources by these multinational corporations. Now, in Guinea-Conakry, now Luwazi, the situation in Congo is one that that has its connection with the resources as well, and is a long-standing one. Can you tell our listeners the basis of the contradiction there?
Yes. The situation in the Congo definitely has its origin in the theft of resources in the Congo, and it also has a source in contradictions, definitely based on this type of economy, because the theft of our resources is the one that provide the basis for colonial economy, and you have elements of the African bourgeoisie who are competing for who will be the one who will provide the resources to imperialism. And you have a different imperialism states or nations also who are backing, you know, their respective forces. And we have also the coming into play of China. And all these, you know, when you put all this together, it creates a situation on the ground where the masses of people are definitely deprived of their own organization, you know, organization built and created by African workers in alliance for peasantry throughout Congo and the region. That type of organization does not exist. So now those who want the resources, they are on the offensive. They do what they want to do, you know, regardless of the cost the people have to pay, you know, looting, killing, and all any kind of unimaginable thing, you know, you can think of. Yeah, it's happening there.
And can you say who are the forces behind the struggle that's happening in Congo?
You have you got the first layer. Let's say you have the forces that everyone can see. You know, you have the factions of African petty bourgeoisie. You got the Congolese elements. You've got the Rwandan element, the Ugandan elements, and to certain degrees, you have the Burundian elements and other Africans in the region. But definitely, you have the Rwandan element, which definitely is backed by the United States and Britain. You remember the war to control Rwanda between France and America that you know, emerged in the 90s and resulting in the genocide we saw in 1994. You have that in place. And then you have the African petty bourgeoisie of Rwanda that lost power in Rwanda and found refuge in the Congo, that as a force is a much diminished force than it used to be, because they have been under assault by the faction that won power, which is in power now in Rwanda. And you have, of course, the faction led by Museveni in Uganda. And you know, Uganda is also a key ally of America and Britain in the region. It's also involved in the Congo. So you have these factions, basically, the one in power in Rwanda, the one in power in Uganda, they are in alliance with the Congolese faction. You know, the African petty bourgeoisie from Congo. And they are providing them with weapons, you know, and stuff like that. And they're involved, basically, in war and killing and doing all that. And this allow the Uganda and the Rwanda faction to get a part of the loot from that part of the Congo. And then on the other side, you have the government of Congo, which is backed by France and by EU, I would say, generally speaking. which is fighting to regain control of the territory, the Congolese territory that is under control by the faction backed by the Rwanda and Ugandan governments. So this is basically what you have. And you also have, as I say, the coming into play of China. You know, China has signed some agreements with the government in Kinshasa, basically the Congolese government. And with these agreements, they promised to build roads, hospitals, schools, you know, stuff like that. And Kabila refers to this agreement, basically the five building sites, I might say, if you translate that this way. So he has promised the people, is going to have five big public construction work. And this depends on the Chinese, you know, providing, you know, the technology, the resources to make it happen. And that in return, he gave the Chinese access to fast, resources in terms of cobalt, copper, you know, and timber and stuff like that. So you have all these elements into play. I'm not sure if I'm being clear there. So basically, you have the U.S. fighting to control, to have hegemonic control of the resources in the Congo with Britain. And you have France also fighting to have its peace in the Congo. And you have China coming into play to advance its own interests. And then United States is on the offensive. Is the one basically who is dictating what's happening there, because the African force that is on the attack, generally speaking, is the one coming from Uganda and Rwanda with the factions based in the Congo.
Okay. Yeah. I found particularly interesting, you know, you see some NGOs, you know, who might single out particular things, you know, that are going on in the Congo. You know, like they may single out the question of the rapes that have gone on and pull these things out as issues of themselves. And I spoke a couple of weeks ago on the radio with a young brother named Kambale Musavuli, who is a student organizer of a campaign called Breaking the Silence, you know, who said that, you know, the rapes were a result of the theft of our resources and an attack on the community, you know. What do you think about that that statement?
Yeah, definitely the rape is just not an attack on our community. It's an attack on all African people, and particularly on the African woman, not just in the Congo. Generally speaking, it's an attack on African women, because what we're seeing today is a level of mass rape never seen before. I'm not saying the African woman has not been raped, you know, throughout slavery and colonialism. This has been happening. But what you see now, you have armed African men who have taken that to a level people don't remember anything like that. I read just for last year alone reports that mentioned 45,000 women are being raped just in that region alone, in the Kivu, you see. Mm-hmm. And it's being done in a way that is just unbelievable. You know, women are being raped, and then they will shoot the woman in the vagina, stuff like that. I've seen countless reports, documentaries, and stuff like that. It's happening there as a way of demoralizing the workers and the peasants. But basically, it's a war against the people, because most of the people are being killed and the women being raped are just part of African working class and peasantry.
Yeah.
You know, so those who are doing it are definitely carrying that agenda, you know, destroy, demoralize the African working class and the peasantry to make sure they don't have the courage to stand up and fight. And also, you know, that area of Kivu historically has been the place where most of the struggle for liberation has started. That was the stronghold of Lumumba. That's where that's where, you know, when Lumumba escaped from Kinshasa, going to the east.
Yeah.
he was heading that region because that was the bastion, you know, of the revolution in the Congo.
I'm speaking with Luwezi Kinshasa, the Secretary General of the African Socialist International, and Cherno Alpha Mba, the Director of Organization of the African Socialist International, based in England and Sierra Leone, respectively. And we're talking about the current situations in Guinea-Conakry and the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'd like to invite those of you who are listening to participate in the discussion that we're having here. You can call one of our numbers. The U.S. number is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. Or you can call the UK number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. Now, we hear every day about Darfur, you know, but the rebellions in Guinea, the conflict in Congo that has killed more than 6 million people are things that are not reported on. Cherno, why do you think that that is?
Well, I think the situation is that part of the strategy of the imperialists is to keep the information away from our people. And the thing is that we know that the United States government has a vested interest in the ongoing crisis in Sudan, just like they have there, and in the Congo and throughout Africa. And what we are witnessing in Africa right now is an ongoing scandal and conflict among the various imperial nations and their corporations to the test and use of our own resources. So the thing is that West Africa generally has been transformed as a fierce battleground among these various corporations. Since the 1990s, late 1980s to throughout the 1990s up to this point, we have seen private armies, national groups, and all of that backed by the population and the new colonial governments who have been carrying out an onslaught against people for the cost of resources. We witnessed a situation in Nigeria where the population has been involved in the construction of the iron ore and the rubber plantation, Sarsen and Lamco, and how Bank Energy and the British equally carried out the same attack against our people in Sierra Leone. And now we have a situation in Guinea-Conakry. And I think that part of the strategy of the imperialists is to keep the information away, the genuine information, staff of people, of the information that is needed for them to know exactly what's happening on the ground. I think it's part of the whole issue of facilitating the test of the results and removing the art of people from the actual contradiction and transforming it as if this is just a minor situation. But what we have in Guinea-Conakry, like in the Congo, is a desperate situation, a situation that has been feared by years or centuries of colonial exploitation, new colonial slavery, the conditions that have been forced on our people by theft of the resources. We have a situation in Guinea where, for instance, the average lifespan of a man is not up to 40 years, and people struggle to earn a single meal a day. People live in a situation where there is no electricity, no adequate services. The worst healthcare facilities, high infant and maternal mortality rates, and all of the other contradictions. While we have a situation where corporations like Alcoa and are looting aluminium resources, bauxite, gold, and other resources that they are taking to North America and Europe. So, yeah, I think that they have an interest in ensuring that this situation is kept away from the people. And depriving us access to freely express our own convictions, to express what is happening to us, because I think that access to genuine information is the first, is one that will allow the people to know exactly what our responsibilities are and what should be done to overcome some of these issues. So I think it's sort of a general strategy that has been employed by imperialism to divert the attention of the masses from the actual contradiction itself.
You know, connected to that, Luwezi, this crisis, this growing instability of neocolonialism in these various places, is it connected to the crisis that's being experienced by the U.S. and European imperialism?
Oh, yes, definitely. Before just answering this, let me just go back to the question of Darfur and what's happening in Congo, why Darfur is in the news and Congo is not in the news. It's easier in Darfur for the U.S. and British and other Europeans to do that because they tend to put the blame on the China support of Bashir's regime. That allows them to hide that they are involved in Darfur. But in the Congo, they can't say anything because it would definitely show Museveni and Kagame. Remember, no, a long time ago, they used to say Kagame and Museveni are examples of African leadership, when we know very, very clearly that Museveni and Kagame are just war criminals, just like the imperialists who are biting them who are themselves war criminals. And if you bring Congo to the news, you're likely to bring a lot of stuff out. Just in a few days that we've been talking about Congo, you begin to see names coming out. You begin to see connections, you know, between those two regimes showing up. And the more people, you know, listen to that, the likely they'll begin to see the hands of U.S. And British imperialism. So it's in their interest not to have it up, you know, just keep it down. If there is a connection between the current crisis, definitely we consider that part of the war, you know, just part of the United States to struggle to organize wars to have monopoly of all these resources is recognition of the crisis itself. That if the United States is able to keep control of those vast resources, that will give them space compared to other imperialists is in contention with. And you begin also to see that the same companies that are looking for money or resources, you will see them that are the ones also involved in the killings, I mean, in funding the current war in the Congo. And we believe definitely what's happening in Africa, you know, what's happening in the Congo, what's happening in Guinea, and Africa, all these are interrelated because they are all parts of the effort of the United States imperialism with its ally to save themselves. And to save themselves, they have to consolidate themselves in the origin of the power, you know, enslavement of Africa. There is no doubt that what's happening in the Congo is definitely part of the U.S. trying to rescue itself from this kind of crisis. The escalation of the war itself just happens when the crisis of imperialism is also escalating. And we don't believe there is a coincidence. You know, we believe, you know, it's definitely a reflection of that.
I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Cherno. I know in your area particularly, you have, you know, things like AFRICOM and the British, you know, being stationed in that region, you know, themselves. I don't know if you have anything you'd like to add to that.
Yes, I think that, like Colonel May said, there is an ongoing effort by the capitalist leading capitalist nations of Europe and the U.S. itself to rescue itself from this current crisis that they are facing by attacking Africa and other oppressed people. That is why it is responsible for the creation of AFRICOM, the current deployment of British troops in Cameroon, and the FBI and all of that. These are agencies and instruments that are put in place to protect the neo-colonial regimes in British and other places that are facilitating the theft of resources. They know that the masses are desperately challenging these neo-colonial regimes, and these are fragile governments, fragile leaders, puppet leaders, whose only stay in power has been facilitated by the rogue alliances that they have with these nations, who have ensured that military forces, troops, are deployed in Africa. We have a several places in Africa that the United States has deployed troops from Djibouti, right up to French deployment in Guinea-Conakry and the FBI, the British troops in Sierra Leone. These are all agents of imperialism that are working in alliance with the neo-colonial regimes that are responsible for the theft of our resources, to ensure that the situation, the masses are kept under control, and that any resistance can be crossed, you know, is a form of containment that deprives us access and our right to self-determination, the ability to move and control our resources by challenging these neo-colonial regimes, and equally crippling their ability to ensure that these resources are taken out by these corporations. So it is part of the whole effort by the capitalists, not by the capitalist nation, by the imperialist countries, to rescue themselves from the ongoing collapse of the market economy, this world economy, capitalist, from this current price at our own expense. So it's a calculated, and it's all connected with this relationship of oppression and exploitation that I've been in for the last 500 years.
And you know, the placement of things, these things like AFRICOM and whatnot, seem to be, you know, in response to a weakened neocolonialism. Is this a trend with neocolonialism? This increased crisis, this increased instability. Is this a trend that we're looking at?
Yes. You go ahead, Comrade. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I believe definitely neocolonialism is unable to secure a stable environment for imperialism to thrive, because you have all these competition between factions of neocolonialism. We will sell to the highest bidder, you know. They have no loyalty. If you can guarantee power to this section, they will go with you. And just look at what's happening in the Congo. You will see definitely elements of the African people which are in the Congo do not give a damn. They will go with the government. If the government can secure the access to wealth, they will go with Museveni. In Uganda, if you can guarantee them access to power and wealth, they can go for Kagame. They can go for anybody who secures them access to wealth and power. And you also have the coming on the scene of China. And you already know you have African leaders who will say, you get a better deal from China than, you know, China doesn't ask questions. If you, how many people you kill, you know, what do? How many wealth you stolen? You know, they don't have all these things. They say, you meet the Chinese today and tomorrow the deal is signed. You know, and they have got no loyalty. And this competition between various oppressed nations to have access to our resources, and also the competition between the African work, African petit bourgeoisie themselves, make the place explosive. And when now you consider the mobilization of the African working class itself, because the people are always fighting and resisting, but we have not been able to provide a revolutionary response to all these crises. So he basically leaves the way open for imperialists like the United States to bring the Africa. Should we become able to mobilize the African workers throughout the continent and every single country, this trend will not have a future at all. But at the moment, definitely the imperialism, they know how weak the imperialist state, the neocolonialist states are. Remember when Mobutu was overthrown, how weak he was exposed he used to be. And the people don't love all these neocolonial government. They all hate it. The state was supposed to be, you know, the backbones of the neocolonial powers. The people hate the state. The people recognize clearly that the police are thieves. The army, they are parts of the apparatus of oppression of the people. So you've got no love of the people, no confidence of the people. How can you be strong? That's impossible. So the imperialists know they have to rely on their own armies to defend their own interests. You know, so it is a trend, likely.
And you know, let's talk about the implications of these particular situations in Guinea-Conakry and in Democratic Republic of Congo. What are the implications for the regions of Africa that they're in? Like Luwezi, the Congo is central to Africa. What are the implications of the situation in Congo?
Yeah, the implication is it's a lot. One, an attack against the African people in the Congo, against Congo itself, is an attack to all African people. For strategic reasons, nine countries around, strategic resources need for industrialization and development of Africa. So you attack Congo, you're attacking the future of African people themselves. And having all these imperialists bring there, you have the UN army. They're talking of 17,000 people, and this doesn't include those involved in administration and stuff like that. And where you have the Indian and the Pakistani being the largest contingent, and you know very well, you can't have the India and the Pakistani armies together in Asia, but they can be together in the Congo. And of course, Rwanda and Uganda, you can say Africa is already there because you have a Rwandan army being trained by the U.S. So is Uganda. There are countless reports of the U.S. Armed forces being involved in the Congo since 1996. You have all these reports. You have Somali being attacked using the African People's Bourgeoisie leadership of, I don't remember the name of the guy, in Ethiopia, in another proxy war. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. Is in there. And then you have Kenya, where the British Army has a basis there. And there are other places. Then you have the French just in Chad. You know, Chad is almost located in Central Africa as well. It's not that far from Cameroon and the Congo, where they can reach West Africa, you know, quickly anytime. They have military bases there. Then they have Ivory Coast. Then they have Senegal. So you begin to see you have all these different imperialist military bases, and some of them might be secret, but we might not know. But we know differently. They are there. Then you have a military agreement between the United States and Egypt. You know, Egypt received, after Israel, I think, is the highest recipient of U.S. military aid. And you have South Africa, of course. You have Botswana. They're all part of the U.S. strategies in Africa. So basically, Africa is not that something is going to be new, because the U.S. already have some kind of military presence in Africa. They're just trying to give it a more strategic form, where it's basically openly recognized as a part of a strategy to contain Africa, as opposed to used to be a power strategy to contain maybe one part, one country, or something like that. But now it's the whole continent of Africa has been given that strategic response from the U.S. imperialism, basically. So the implication is deep. It's really deep, and we have to work really hard. Revolutionary struggle has to become the norm in every single African country. You know, people are tired to seeing always the African petty bourgeoisie fighting among themselves. And as they fight among themselves for power, they kill the people, they destroy the people, they destroy their, you know, the meager, inexistent pool structures the country might have anywhere in Africa. You know, we must be able to build this revolution organization so we can begin to give the African people a vision of a united set of Africa and the leadership of African working class. We have to be everywhere, and we have to be everywhere soon, you know.
Yes. And you know, Comrade Trunnell, I'd like to ask also the implications of the rebellion in Guinea for West Africa. I know that there was a conference that the African Socialist International held there recently. And in the context of that, what are the implications of the rebellion in Guinea?
Well, like Comrade Louis just said, the ongoing rebellions in Guinea-Conakry have very serious implications for the ability of the neo-colonialist regimes in this region to continue to loot resources with impunity. Because for a very long time, I think they have been, having a field day, keeping away the resources and keeping the masses in abject poverty. So, in the conference, one of the resolutions in the general resolution was a call that the ongoing exploitation of the resources of Africa by multinational corporations, and in this case the Bank of Nigeria and the other corporations involved in terms of these resources, have to be resisted by Africans throughout the world, and that multinational corporate exploitation must be brought to a halt. So this demonstrations or the ongoing rebellions happened just 2 weeks after the conference. So it has a serious implications because it has already challenged the ability of the corporations to continue to move the resources out, because since the start of the rebellions in Guinea-Conakry, mining activities have been brought to a halt because about 3 trains that were taken bauxite from Kansar and Boke, which are areas that are controlled by Alcoa and Kara respectively, were besieged. And, this has affected the output of aluminium. I think the price of aluminium has even gone up in the world market. And that is a clear start of an ongoing situation. And what we are currently working on is the question of bringing together all these working organizations, workers' organizations, trade unions, and miners' unions, peasants' organizations, into some kind of arrangement that will allow us to declare something like a coordinated action against multinational corporate exploitation. The thing is that this is a signal that is going out to the populations as well as the neo-colonial regimes and imperialist forces that are protecting these regimes, that the masses are desperately moving towards the culture of taking back our resources and finding themselves with ammunition. So the situation in Guinea has been going on now for more than a year, and still it shows that the masses are restless and that they are desperately eager to free themselves from the stagnating conditions that have been imposed on them by decades of neo-colonial exploitation, imperialist domination, and multinational corporate exploitation. So this will equally fail the desire on the part of the masses in other areas like in Sierra Leone and in Nigeria. And in Nigeria as well, there's an ongoing struggle led by men in the America that is currently challenging the ability of corporations in that area to steal oil from that part of Africa. So this is part of a movement in motion, massive in motion, challenging the ability of the imperialists to continue to live off these resources. I think it has serious implications. It challenges the ability of these forces to continue to do the resources, and it provides hope and a form of inspiration on the part of the people to move towards the question of forcefully taking the resources and forcing this corporation out. So it is already something that is in motion. What is required, like already said, is for us to put to provide leadership for these struggles and move, lift them to more advanced level, more higher level as part of a national democratic revolutionary program. A national democratic revolutionary program was introduced in Guinea since last year, and these rebellions and are currently going on in Guinea may have been influenced largely by the demands in that program. So I think it's a general phenomenon now. It is one that is going to be replicated in most parts of West Africa and beyond. So it has serious implications, and it is one that is part of the general approach to the question of self-determination in West Africa and beyond.
Uhuru, We have just a few minutes left, and I want to take this opportunity to allow the two of you to tell our listeners, those who may be listening in the areas that you're involved in, who may be interested in joining in with the work of the African Socialist International, how they could be in contact with you. Beginning with Luwazi, how can someone get in contact with the Office of the General Secretary of the ASI?
If you are in England, so in Europe here, you can write us. You can write to us using uhuruasi@aol.com. Uhuru is spelled uhuruasi@aol.com. Or you can phone us on our 0208-265-1731. And I'm sure if you write to us or you phone us, we definitely talk to you or come back to you as soon as possible, definitely. So we look forward to get your calls or get your emails.
And Mafrika Cherno, if someone wants to get in touch with the Office of the Directive Organization for the ASI.
Well, I think, the most easiest way of getting information about the ASI is for everyone to constantly check on the website of the African Socialist International, which is www.asiuhuru.org. ASIUHURU.org, UHURU.org. And information is being posted regularly as we get it. Information on how to contact the General Secretary, the director of organization. And apart from that, we are currently working on putting organizations, committees throughout Africa. And right now we have a national coordinating committee in Sierra Leone and in Guinea-Conakry and in Liberia and beyond. We have already inaugurated the West Africa Regional Committee of the ASI. And we are working on building the other regional conferences of the ASI to accomplish the same objectives. And if we could be contacted, I could be contacted to email africanist@yahoo.com, africanist@yahoo.com, and 232-76-757924. That's 232-76-757924. Like I said, this information is also available on the ASI website, and we will encourage people to check on the ASI website and uhurunews.com and all the stuff. I think they will be able to get in touch with the various departments of the ASI.
Uhuru. I want to, again, thank you, comrades, so much for being on the air with us today. It's extremely helpful, I think, for Africans to be able to sum up what's going on in these different areas in the world and how we jump in, how we participate in deepening the crisis of imperialism and overturning our oppression and liberating and uniting our Africa. Again, thank you so much for participating with us today, and it's always good to have you on.
Thank you, Uhuru. Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you. No compromise, no surrender.
Israele too.
Yeah, Africa.
In Africa.
And that's it for Africa Live today. But that's okay, because next up you have Uhuru on the move with your host, Impidum President Ivory Sobukwe Sodaye. And comrade Kobina Bantu Shango. So stay tuned next up on uhururadio.com.
See what I'm saying, ain't Binga. Nobody gonna do this for us but us.
Talk about a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying? The question ain't whether we vote for white power and white face or white power and black face. The question is whether we will be be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. This is African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here we're talking about the African working class. What we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands.